From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. There are certain stereotypes about how men approach friendship, and it usually involves beer or sports or both. But what really goes into the relationships that men forge with one another? Today we're going to discuss how men communicate with their male friends, whether men have fewer close friends than women do, and if so, does it give rise to loneliness or depression? Joining me in the studio, Bruce Thompson. He's a professor of psychology, focusing on human development at the University of Southern Maine. And Rebecca Schwartz-Mehta is a professor of clinical psychology and director of the Peer Relations Lab at the University of Maine. And as always, we want to hear from you. Do you think men have trouble making or maintaining close friends? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Bruce and Becca, welcome to Maine Calling. Becca, we'll start with you. This premise that men are not as good at making and keeping friendships, is this a fair premise? Does it have any supporting materials in the research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think historically, the prevailing dominant thinking about men's friendships was that they weren't as intimate as women's friendships or girls and women's friendships. That, you know, as you said, yes, that, you know, guys get together and have a beer and that's it. And in recent decades, research has really uncovered, I think, some hidden strengths of boys and men's friendships as we've understood better how they develop intimacy with their friends. So, for instance, one of the strongest gender differences with regard to friendship between boys and girls or men and women is that boys and men tend to hang out in groups as opposed to dyads. Girls and women tend to kind of get together one-on-one. And boys and men's social interactions tend to be organized around activities, you know, where they do something together, whereas, female friendships, you see a lot more of that kind of intimate disclosure, sort of sitting around and talking.
And does that tendency to do stuff extend then into adulthood? Playing cops and robbers turn into bowling?
I think so. Yeah. So, in later childhood and adolescence, that's really when friendships become the primary source of individuals' social support. You know, the influence of parents starts to wane. And so I think the activities or the patterns in friendships that get set down in adolescence really carry forth. And you do see those gender differences in adult friendships where, you know, men are, you know, their interactions really, they're doing something. They might also be talking, you know, but they're doing something.
Bruce, you also look at human development as well. What are the biggest differences in how males and females talk to one another?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll paraphrase a well-known expression, which is that the difference can be characterized as rapport building versus report making, female and male respectively. So oftentimes you hear, again, it's stereotypes that men are trying to establish some sort of hegemonic boundaries, which is to say sort of power structures or status. And the stereotype, conversely, is that women are trying to make connections and do the rapport building. And there's a kernel of truth to that, but I think we also have to be super careful of falling into the trap of generalizing and trying to compartmentalize certain constructs. Another thing that certainly jumps to my mind right off the bat as we try to unpack this really complicated topic is to maybe reframe the question from not being an issue of men and friendships, but rather masculinity as a principle within friendships. So that's a very common critique of the literature that you see nowadays, that we shouldn't be talking about male equals masculinity and female equals femininity and then try to build the friendship structures around there. You could be a female with masculine-oriented friendship patterns, and you could be male, conversely, with very feminine characteristics within your friendship pattern. So the whole conversation can be really broadened out to many different sort of dimensions.
Talk about, Bruce, we'll stay with you for the moment, the role that parents play, particularly in the case of boys and their fathers and the role that that modeling plays there with how they develop friendships or even learn to be a friend?
Mm-hmm. Great question. This may well be at the very root of not only friendships, but any kind of development into well-adjusted mental health, sort of secure individuals. So it's not just boys and their friends, but the question really addresses things like attachment and on the negative side, attachment disorders and so on. I think there's very strong evidence that children develop cognitive, we'll call them social cognitive schemas that center around what they witness all the time. It's not; it doesn't have to be direct instruction, like this is how you're supposed to handle yourself, son. It can be modeling that can be very, very powerful. Children build schemes, which are really kind of like, think of a scheme as a way your brain categorizes information. It's not, in the child's mind, it doesn't have to be this is good, this is bad. It's just this is reality. This is the data I've collected about this experience. And if that experience is dad being aggressive and hostile towards mom or showing a lot of friendship patterns that are not very healthy, you know, based on power structures, say, instead of intimacy and respect and so on, that can feed into what they build as the picture of a friendship. And they don't have the, you know, little kids don't often have the capacity to reflect on whether that's good for me or healthy. It's just, it is the reality that they start to see.
Yeah. And Becca, is it fair to say, though, that if a child sees their dad with, you know, lots of male friends and they're physical with each other and they support each other, I mean, is that going to affect how they move forward with their own friendship developments?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's so important for kids to see their parents maintain social interactions in adulthood and have fun with their friends, you know, to put it plainly that, you know, certainly, you know, family responsibilities, work responsibilities can kind of, you know, get in the way of those, you know, close friendships, you know, or spending as much time with friends as one used to. But I think it's huge, you know, as you were saying, Bruce, just the modeling and, you know, I think, you know, what we're learning more and more about men's friendships is that they might have something figured out. You know, they've got this kind of activity side of thing where they're doing things, they're staying active, and that's great for recreation and companionship and all of that. And then they are also talking about problems, you know, with their friends, but they're not, they don't seem to do it to the same, maybe more extreme extent that on average women tend to do. And one of the things that I've been studying in my work is the ways in which men and women communicate in their friendships and how that relates to how well they're doing with their mental health. You know, and it seems that, you know, women might take that kind of disclosure thing too far sometimes and focus so much on just talking about, you know, what's going wrong, or, you know, they might feel really close with their friends and feel very supportive. But, you know, what the data would say is that, you know, maybe guys take on that, which is to talk a little bit, but also be really active and do fun things with their friends, is actually better for their mental health in terms of depression and anxiety.
I'm wondering about social pressures. I mean, I think back to in terms of modeling, I think back to when I was young, the iconic image of John Kennedy in his short pants and red shoes, you know, stepping forward at his father's funeral and issuing the salute. To this, I remember my parents were so impressed and said, the suggestion was this is the image of strength and whatever that you know, was being put forward, and that was sort of throughout society that men were supposed to be tough and hide their emotion even on their third birthday. Is that waning somewhat, Bruce?
I think it is, but only in certain sectors of society. In certain, it could be a socioeconomic status difference. You may find those patterns either waning or waxing. Cultural differences can be very, very important. What you described in the John Kennedy Jr. moment was, I would describe as male stoicism, and I'm guessing that it didn't come naturally to him, but he was coached very heavily in the hours before that moment took place. That photograph of him saluting his fallen father and president of the United States was, you know, it's hugely poignant, and I think people are moved by that and impressed by his manliness. And I don't think it's not positive or negative. It's just something that was absolutely scripted.
But there have been other changes where, and again, I'm not a sociologist, or, but there was a time when, in those days, when dad got through with work and maybe he went out to the third place. It wasn't work. It wasn't home. It was his third place. And sometimes it was a bar. And he socialized there. Now it's expected, and many fathers would prefer to come home and share in the family duties and be with their children. And so they lose that level of connection, that third place connection as a social center. Not saying that's a bad thing, but it's a way that it's changing for men in terms of where they socialize and how they establish friends.
Mm-hmm. I think men are given permission to prefer getting home and being a domestic partner and a contributor to family life and child rearing and so on. I think there's greater acceptance of that among male colleagues and friends. So I think that's a big advancement, a social advancement that I think we're seeing. But in a way, we could almost take a page out of an environmental biologist book and refer to phrases like niche picking, or you know, this, or an organism will have the genetic motivators to find an environment that suits its capabilities and its resources best. So it's going to be full of individual differences. There's going to be some men who have a temperament that makes them very attracted to and motivated to be home with people connecting emotionally, and some who need downtime in other ways.
I was going to say, can we look to evolution to explain or inform our understandings about the differences, gender differences, and how men and women communicate?
I think we absolutely can, although there's always the health warning, which is don't try to use sort of things from slightly discredited sociobiology perspectives where you find something that you suspect is genetic and then try to let it explain everything. But yes, absolutely. One of my points I make to students is that if they try to look at the current ways in which we define friendship, certain pressures and anxieties that men face and so on, and we only look at today or even the last 10 years, we're looking through human life through a straw, and we need to sort of see the massive continuity that you might be able to see within tens of thousands of years of evolution. And so it raises the question, if men are have a tendency to be less motivated to form intimate communicative bonds with people, And if that's going back eons into the mists of time, what was the advantage? Because there had to have been, otherwise it would have been extinguished as a part of natural selection. And that doesn't make it good or bad. It just means where did this come from, perhaps?
Do you have any thoughts about, if we assume it's true, where it came from?
Again, anytime you talk about evolution, you have to be a little cautious because you're speculating on possibilities that don't often have physical evidence. Yes, you can be an archaeologist and dig up bones and I guess find shards of pottery or something in a site. But many things have to be speculation. But sure, there's plenty of valid theories that there's a connection between male avoidance of physical affection and intimacy, and that's connected to the emotional too. And that could have been something to do with having to minimize your sense of vulnerability. I think that's a common theme you hear, that men are more afraid of emotional vulnerability, and that could date back to tens of thousands of years when it was part of an intersexual selection game.
Mm-hmm. Becca, what does this mean then? What are the consequences of this if we accept the premise that there are these differences? And you would say there are men have some advantages, as you said. But are there consequences for men, for example, in midlife with fewer friends? Is there an equation that leads to depression or other mental health issues?
Yeah. I mean, I think, for me, it's when I think about this, it's a lot about balance. So, you know, too much friends and just talking all the time and socializing and not having that balance with family life or work life, you know, that's not good. Or being on the other end of it where you have absolutely no socialization going on, you know. So I think it's about balance. And when we look at, you know, how friendships impact mental health, I mean, we see that borne out, that it really is that sort of balance of not just all intimate communication and talking about thoughts and feelings ad nauseum, you know, but balancing that with fun activities, to get out and actually, you know, do things. You know, I think that's really important. So on the other end, you know, talking not at all or not having those emotional connections, I think, can be really isolating as well. And so, you know, when I was mentioning the kind of, you know, potential hidden benefits of men's friendships, you know, historically speaking, we're talking about history, you know, the stereotype or on average men being less communicative, not opening up, not bearing their soul, you know, just, you know, throwing the football around or what have you. We're seeing now that, you know, as long as they have, you know, a little bit of that and a little bit of that emotional connection with friends, they're actually maybe protected against developing depression and anxiety. And then women who, again, I'm speaking on average here, with their female friends just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, are actually more at risk for depression and anxiety. So for me, you know, thinking about how to have the healthiest life, it's really about balance.
But going back to, I guess, you know, social attitudes about friendships, it's perfectly acceptable and fine for women to have a close, intimate relationship. It's almost expected that they will. And for men, you know, we have this almost pejorative phrase, bromance, you know, which if two men are seen being overly close or caring for each other, everybody in the room gets nervous and we laugh about it and call it bromance. What is it, Bruce, that we're nervous about?
Well, if we're nervous about it, and I would first question the premise that we're all nervous. I mean, I don't think there are many people anymore that are that nervous about it, because it's a word that's been thrown around a lot. And I'm really pleased to hear the word used often, not as a pejorative, as something that, hey, here's a safe, in quotes, way men can achieve some kind of intimate friendship that's communicative and affectionate even, and yet there is, I think, it doesn't have that strong a connotation of gay, homosexual. It almost by definition is an affectionate friendship between two heterosexual men.
But sexuality, even taken out of it, there's something about just two men being very close makes people uncomfortable. And to some people,
I agree, and I think for people, and that might be a minority. Who knows? But for the people who are made uncomfortable by bromances that they witness at a cafe, I think it's likely is because it's triggering in their mind violations of gender roles and sexuality roles. But if there's this wonderful quote from a paper that came out just this year by Stefan Robinson, came out in Sex Roles, which is a really high-tier gender journal. A great defining quote is, participants described a bromance as being more emotionally intimate, physically demonstrative, and based upon unrivaled trust and cohesion compared to their other friendships. It's very positive. Sounds actually to me like a typical female friendship that you described, which suggests that there's a coming together of two models of what can be an appropriate friendship.
Right. Which may reflect the increasing kind of fluidity of what we accept of both genders.
Absolutely.
You know, which is kind of the historical time we're in now.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we're talking about men and friendship. Joining me in the studio, Bruce Thompson, psychology professor at the University of Southern Maine. He specializes in human development. And Becca Schwartz-Mehta, psychology professor at the University of Maine. She heads the Peer Relations Lab there. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is David Ward. He's a licensed clinical social worker and a psychotherapist in private practice in Yarmouth, who's been working with men for more than 25 years. David, thank you for calling in.
Thanks for having me, Keith.
What sorts of issues do your male clients come to you with in terms of friendships or relationships?
You know, a lot of what the panel has been talking about so far, and it's been a great conversation, you know, what I see and hear from men is a lot of that loneliness and isolation, and some of the friendships that they've had have fallen off over the years because of growing up, having a family, work, all of that stuff, sometimes people moving away. And as men not really being socialized to keep and develop those friendships. You know, to me, we have to remember, I've heard that, you know, men connect through activity, but we often forget that talking is an actual activity. The men who come to my office have to get in their car, drive over, spend the time, whether individually or in group, and I'm, you know, ask them to take risks in talking about what they're thinking and feeling. That's a pretty major activity for a man, and we get a lot of messages around that that's not okay to do that, that that's not masculine.
Mm. You mentioned group therapy. You work in group men's groups. How does that work, and why is it helpful in a group setting?
Well, one of the reasons is because it really does break that isolation and loneliness and provides men with some social support, as well as some men, it's the first time that they're experiencing, wow, somebody else thinks and feels that way. I thought I was the only one.
Hmm. Do you feel that there is a higher risk among men than in women in terms of not having close friends, the consequences of that? That play out in loneliness or anxiety?
Well, I think it can be a risk for both men and women because that social isolation can certainly cause depression or play a role in depression for both men and women. But I think women, thankfully, are much more socialized to be able to rely on that, and there's a cultural acceptance that that's okay. For men, it's more of being self-reliant, it's not okay to have needs, don't admit any weaknesses. So, you know, we can bowl a perfect game and have a beer with a buddy, which is all great, and that's a fun activity. But if men are looking for something deeper or want more intimacy, it's really about taking some of those risks. And I talk with men about, just like when you're trying to find a relationship, what ponds are you fishing in? You know, if you're going to a bar to find a relationship, you're probably going to find that level of relationship. If you want something more meaningful or deeper, it's looking at other places or activities that feed you and finding other men that you can connect with there.
Right. David, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Ward is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist based in Yarmouth. I was having this thought the other day, you know, there's this emergence of people trying to find romantic partners online through Match.com and some of these other sites. I'm wondering, could that not be extended to finding friends online if you're lonely and you want to find a compatible friend?
Sort of like Tinder for friendships, right? Swipe left. I don't use it, so I don't know which way you're supposed to swipe.
Yeah.
Well, I think even having the conversation about how do adults find friends, whether they're men or women, I mean, I think it really illuminates the point that once you're out of formal schooling, once you're out of college, once you're out of that first, you know, those first few stages of your career, kind of the making friends, it's not something that everybody is doing. And so it can be really hard, I think, to find a place. And so, you know, maybe there is an answer or some help in technology.
I would just add, absolutely agree. It's a good point that at the end of your secondary school timing, and if you go to college, that when that period ends, those are environments that are highly supportive of inclusive models of what can be a friend. Heterosexual, any sort of non-binary way that gender is defined can be sort of explored. But when you go and get a job, you may, especially for men, they may likely find themselves in a position, a job, where it's much more homogenous. The boundaries may become far more restrictive in what is sort of accepted as friendship. So that can be a real shock to the system, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Joining us now is Theo Green. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Bowdoin College. Theo, thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
So you focus on the concept of masculinity in your research. Is there a problem with men having to prove that they are masculine, and how does that relate to their ability to make close friends?
You know, one of the things that we always say in masculinity studies is that we always are encountering a crisis of masculinity, right? So historically, men have always been struggling to sort of prove themselves based on definitions of what it is to be a man. And I think today we're entering this very interesting historical period where you are beginning to see some of those mores of masculinity loosening up, which can shape certain kinds of friendship and friendship relations at the expense of others. And so the rise of the bromance, for example, which allows men to be able to engage in more inclusive masculinities, accepting more of homosexuality, right? They're sort of getting rid of that sense of homo hysteria that once predominated and defined hegemonic masculinity. Where you get now to see men being able to say, I love you, man, even if it is jocular. And yet there's certain aspects of masculinity that still is close to the vest in terms of expressing vulnerability when people are sad or scared. And that plays a huge role, I think, in shaping the kinds of relationships that men cultivate with one another.
Is there pressure then on men today to sort of strike this a balance then between being manly and being sensitive?
Absolutely. And I think increasingly what you see is these kinds of trade-offs happening. We see that in popular culture all the time. In my classes, I show the first day this Dove commercial, right, where a man is sort of really enjoying soap in the shower, and his wife told him that it's actually Dove soap, and then he runs out, right, and does all these manly things. And I think you definitely see various kinds of ways in which men sort of trade off taking on a greater sense of sensitivity in exchange for also claiming a sense of masculinity, right, whether that is through the presentation, right, maintaining a certain kind of body structure, whether it is the kinds of activities that they sort of engage in. I think you see a number of ways in which, men really hold on to that sense of what it is to be a man, even as we see, again, these mores loosen up a little bit.
And why do they? Why cling to this so desperately?
In a lot of ways, masculinity is a social construction. So we're still in a stage where men are engaging in this kind of proving ground to one another to become, emphasize themselves as predominant. I think that's the real construction of masculinity that men have not been able to let go, is being able to think that they can do everything and hold on to everything. And that comes from socialization, right? Our fathers and what our fathers mirrored to us to be strong, to be capable, to be able to provide for our families. And it plays a role in, I think, the kinds of relationships we sort of create for each other in schools in terms of how to present ourselves. So there's numbers of studies that show, for example, that kindergarten kids, in order to dissociate themselves from their mothers when their mothers drop them off and give them a kiss, often talk about guns to be able to sort of, distance themselves from, the hypersensitivity that comes if they show too much affection for their mothers in public. So, again, we see the very pervasive power of socialization in terms of shaping the kinds of masculine constructs we take on.
Now, Theo Green, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Theo Green teaches sociology at Bowdoin College, focusing on the study of men and masculinity. The number 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to the phones to Nick in Livermore Falls. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the program. Hi, Nick, go ahead, please. All right, we don't have Nick. We're going to try Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, listen, it's a great topic. I'm sorry I called in listening so late because I wrote my dissertation on male intimacy between friends back in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm a man in my 70s now, and what I discovered back then, or what I, through the literature and through the research I was doing, that male friendship, at least at this time, the way it was constituted, was through challenging each other and engaging in it's a shoulder to shoulder activity, where a third item is there. It's a world. It could be a world of sports or a world of any other endeavor, where a certain kind of challenge comes in, and through this challenging, a level of joy is experienced in the challenge and in the friendship. So we can share sorrow. We can. Recently, a friend of mine lost a child, which is really a devastating event, as you can imagine. But what we discovered as his friends was, when he wanted to be with us, he wanted to play the sports that we played. We played basketball and tennis and so forth. And that's what he wanted to do. It wasn't that he didn't want to talk about this terrible loss, but he wanted the engagement with his men friends in the sport that we love.
Yeah, and Becca, you were, sorry to cut you off, Scott, but Becca, this is what you were talking about.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much for calling in and for your story. It reminds me of, when we study kids' friendships, when they're laying down these patterns, we ask them to talk to their best friend about something. And I was smiling when I was listening to your story because, all the girls get in and they get right to it and start talking. And what we noticed with the boys was that they would smuggle in foreign objects, like a football, into our little experimental room. And they would toss the football back and forth with one another or whatever it was, play with something, and then have the same level of intimate conversation with their friends as the girls did, quote unquote. And it was so, I think, touching and lovely. But just as you said, they need that world or that third object. And maybe somehow that allows that connection. And then we do see that same level of connection, that same level of intimacy, as in traditional female friendships. So thanks for your story.
Yeah, Scott, I didn't want to cut you off. Did you want to...
Yeah, there's one other item I'd like to share. I was recently with a gathering of about 13, 14 of us. We have a mentor. I'm in my 70s now. He's in his 90s, and the gentleman is dying. He was a great coach and teacher for us. And, we got together with him, and we all knew he's dying. He knows he's dying, of course. That's why we got together. But, we never mentioned that fact, neither did he. What he wanted to talk about was what had brought us together. And he was a great soccer and swimming coach and he's still alive, but he's in extremis now. And it was marvelous to see how happy the occasion was. There wasn't a lot of sadness. There was a kind of a revelation of his life and all he had done. And he's had a tremendous life. And I just came away from that, seeing again how much of these friendships, male friendships, are centered on a kind of joyous activity, engagement in joyous activity, both for straight and gay males. I have a gay brother, and he speaks the same way about this phenomenon with his friends. So I just thought I'd like to share that with you.
All right, Scott, thanks very much. We are going to take a quick break. First, a word about tomorrow's show. As summer winds down, join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about family road trips. She'll be joined by the author of the new book, Don't Make Me Pull Over. We'd love to hear your recollections of a family vacation all crammed into a car. Email us at talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how do men approach friendship? Joining us today, two psychology professors, Becca Schwartz-Mehta is with UMaine, and Bruce Thompson is with USM. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I read one report that said men's close male friendships actually matter more to them than their relationships with their female partners. Now, I'm not... don't throw anything, but it was one take on this. Any response to that... idea, Becca?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, you said don't throw anything. And I think maybe the potential for people to have a strong reaction to that gets back at that socialization thing that we were just talking about, that why can't their friendships mean that much to them? That's fantastic. I don't know that we would question that around female friendships so much. But I think, friends do matter. And I think as people move through adulthood, it becomes just less salient for people, or people think it matters less, but it really doesn't. Friends are super important for emotional adjustment.
And I would add that a lot depends on the expectations and the needs of this fictional hypothetical partner of this person who has more joy or more motivation to be with his male friends and values that more than his, I assume it's a heterosexual, traditional male-female partnership. But that can work as long as the expectations that are within that separate relationship are balanced and support that.
Yep. Let's go to Jim in Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to bring into the conversation something that I got years ago from an old sage, C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Four Loves. And he's talking in one chapter about the idea of filial love, which is friendship love. And his definition, I think, was very helpful for me. And I think it adds something to this conversation. He said that while others, people, acquaintances, deal with each other sort of the face-to-face, even close face-to-face level, a friend is somebody who stands beside you and looks out at the world, and you and that friend see the same things the same way. It's a shared understanding of the world that you love. You love the same things, you hate the same things. And so your friendship is based on, first of all, on the, how you look outward. And then when there's issues to deal with, like problems, you deal with the problems, Lewis said, so you can get back to the thing that makes your friendship valuable.
That really harkens back to some remarks I believe that Scott made and also came up in other ways here, which is this idea of the other entity. And in this case, it could be sitting on a mountaintop that you both climb together, looking out over. And if you're both having the mutual appreciation of something, and then there's the triangle is complete. I'm seeing something valuable to me. We both got here together. You see it too, and we both have a shared experience. That's a form of communicative intimacy, but it doesn't look like most stereotypical female or feminine, I should say, feminine friendship patterns. And Becca's really right on remark about something like a football being something that they share and then get started. That's a catalyst, I would describe it. But there also can be something that's absent, and there's some – it's not absent, but there's a proxy. We can talk about proxy experiences that count as the connectedness, a shared experience, an achievement together, and so on. So I think that's really spot on.
All right, let's go to Willie and Gardner. Hi, Willie. Welcome to the program.
No, thank you. I'm the founder of Mainly Men, and I don't know anybody who knows about Mainly Men, but it's a men's group that's been going for over 35 years, and it meets twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall. It is open to all men. And I started it because I realized that I didn't have relationships like my female friends did. And I wanted to do that, and I wanted to have some men friends. So part of starting it was selfish. And so that's why I started it. But there's been well over 3,000 men go to Mainly Men in the over 35 years.
So 35 years ago, this is not a new idea then, this topic that we're discussing today. There was somebody felt a deficit in your case, you thought it would be a good idea to start the group. What have you discovered, Willie, over those 35 years, that there's a great need for this that's sort of very quiet?
Oh, there's a huge need. And being a Maine native, I think it's even more important. But one of the things Mainly Men does is give men a safe place to be able to search on what they've always been looking for. And I have six unbelievable male friends that I love, and they would do anything for me, and vice versa. And I feel very fortunate as a male to have those six men. But you got to work at it really hard, and you're going to have to know that you're going to have to probably take some grief in life, but it's worth it. Mm. And that if you keep plugging at it, it will happen. And there are men out there who want to have male friendships and want to have male communication. I kiss my male friends. I hug my male friends. And I'm heterosexual. And I wouldn't know what to do without them now. And if anyone's interested in Mainly Men, you can go on the computer. It's mainlymen.org.
Yeah.
And it'll be a group in October.
Okay. Willie, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. Let's go to Adolf in Wells. Hi, Adolf.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I agree with the last caller and also the caller prior to that. And one of the things that I wanted to say is that I don't know if the distinction was made between acquaintance and friend. And a lot of people will say that I have a dozen friends when maybe 11 of them are really acquaintances. A friend is someone that you can share a two-way street with. It goes back and forth, and it's a nurturing thing that flows between two people, and you share the good with the bad. Mm. And also, I wanted to also say that a lot of the program that was about today was the so-called maleness and this extension on male. Well, I'm also a heterosexual, and I have a very, very good homosexual friend. And the way he thinks of being male is very different from the way I think of being a male. So just saying male is probably not enough. It's really about defining what a true friendship is. And I just thought I would like to get the comments from your guests.
Yeah, great point, Adolf. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think you make a wonderful point. You know, there are so many aspects of identity, and, you know, a lot of the research has really been conducted on traditional definitions of masculinity and femininity or traditional gender roles. And, you know, of course, as you wisely bring up, there can be important intersections with sexual orientation, and the ways in which we define any aspect of our identity, you know, are certainly not one-dimensional. And unfortunately, you know, we're still at the phase of trying to accumulate more understanding of all the different permutations of aspects of identity. And so I really appreciate you bringing that up because I think it's important.
Yeah. Any thoughts, members?
Yes, absolutely. I think your perception, your description describes an enlightened place in terms of defining what is normal, what is okay, what is healthy, especially when it comes to heterosexual friendships crossed with homosexual friendships. In other words, cross-sexuality friendships are something that are far more accepted nowadays, but would have been extremely awkward and difficult to achieve and dangerous, socially and maybe even physically dangerous in past decades. I was just reading more on this just a day or two ago. Nick Rubens in Journal of Gender Studies just this year published a paper that's called Age and Changing Masculinities in Gay, Straight, Male Workplace Friendships. And one thing that he reports is that there's age differences. We might call those cohort effects, where maybe it's millennials, maybe even a younger generation of young men have a high comfort level with friendships with gay men, so straight gay friendships. And I think it's a really positive change because there can be amazing discoveries about what can be shared without ever compromising or threatening each other's status and where they are. The greater challenge is when we have older generation men trying to achieve that kind of friendship that's on that level.
Let's go to we're almost out of time here, but we'll bring in Steve, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm wondering to what extent the ability of men and women to make friends may be age-related. I'm 69 years old, and I have observed over the years that the older men get, the harder it seems for them to make new good friendships, and the easier it seems for women to do that. I'm wondering if anyone has any thoughts on the age related, whether there's an age-related aspect to this.
Okay. Steve, thank you. Any thoughts, Becca?
Yeah, I mean, I think of a couple of things, you know. Opportunity, you know, sort of context, you know, what people, older adults are doing with their days, you know, if there aren't a lot of activities or contexts in which you can meet people or even meet new people, you know, that may be one barrier. I also think it gets back to our discussion on socialization, what is quote unquote acceptable in our culture. It's totally acceptable for a bunch of women to get around together and talk and hang out, you know, but it may be in some circles or in some contexts less acceptable for men. And so, you know, I think about context and socialization.
Mm-hmm. I would absolutely agree with that. I would like to bring up a term that isn't mentioned very often these days, which is androgyny. You know, we think of that as someone who's a David Bowie-like person who's physically androgynous looking by design. But androgyny really is about the way you establish relationships, your own identity as a person. And there is a lot of supportive research suggesting that men and women become more androgynous with age, which is to say men become more comfortable accepting feminine characteristics that they had latent in their temperament or their somehow in their disposition, but was had to be hidden through their youth. Conversely, women experience a sort of empowerment as they have professional achievements and child rearing may be over, and they have opportunities to compete, to be powerful, to be politically active. And so there's a wonderful fusion that can be possible that could positively impact friendships.
This other theme seems to have popped up a few times, which is that it takes work to maintain a relationship, right? Like any relationship. Is there any work being done on sort of men's skill at maintaining? Maybe you make friends, you're thrown together at a football game, you get along, you're friends, but following up on that, nurturing that over time takes work, and those fall away. Is that part of what's happening maybe?
I'm not sure. I mean, when you were saying that, I was nodding, and what popped into my head is that boys and men in some ways are actually better at that than women. Some of the research would indicate that women tend to be more jealous, hold more grudges, may end friendships, you know, whereas, you know, again, we're speaking in stereotypes, but, you know, guys have an argument, they may shove each other around a lot and then slap each other on the back and it's done, you know, so there may be, you know, the conflict resolution skills, you know, males may have a leg up on that.
All right, let's take one last call. Warren in Damariscotta. Hi, Warren. Real quickly, please, if you could.
Sure. Well, Steve addressed some of what I was curious about. About 10 years ago, I and two friends had breakfast, and it has morphed into a breakfast group. 10 years later, we're 15 people on a regular basis every Monday, and in the summer, it inflates because of summer visitors. I keep being told that it's most unusual for men to get together and for this to endure. So I was curious whether that's true or not, because obviously we're all together and enduring. And the bigger point was I was most curious about relationships over time how you see some of the, you know, the effects of time on the quality of relationships between men. And as a post note, a lot of the fellas have created friendships within the group, but there's no romance. It's a kind of everybody's between 60 and 70 with the occasional 90-year-old.
Okay. Right. Yeah, Warren, thanks very much. Any quick final thoughts? We've got about 60 seconds left.
What I take from that is that there's a range of what we can call friendship. He seems to be describing something that's much deeper than, say, acquaintances who are happy to be together, but it's not quite the same. It doesn't necessarily, there's no pressure even to reach that level of deep, enduring friendship either. So there's diversity that's fine within what you can call a friendship.
Yeah.
And who knows how common it is, but I think it's awesome. So good for you and enjoy your breakfast.
Yeah, I'll close the show by saying I'm very lucky to have a pretty big circle of male friends that I've known for 30 years, and we're very close. So I can vouch for this. It's a really unbelievable asset to have and to maintain. And with that, we're out of time. I appreciate it both very much. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Rebecca Schwartz-Mehta is a University of Maine professor of clinical psychology and director of the Peer Relations Lab. Bruce Thompson is a professor of psychology specializing in human development at the University of Southern Maine. George Thomas ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Tales of Family Road Trips. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.